From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Democratic presidential candidates Bill Clinton, Paul Tsongas, and Jerry Brown are campaigning in Illinois and Michigan today. All three have been courting organized labor. Tsongas, who needs a win in either state, has poured money into advertising leading up to the Tuesday primary. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports from Chicago.
Coming out of the Super Tuesday Southern sweep for Clinton, Tsongas desperately needs to prove that he's still a viable candidate. Although Tsongas has repeatedly called for an end to negative advertising, he launched $300,000 worth of ads this week in Illinois and Michigan that are aimed at Clinton's character. Tsongas is the exact opposite of Bill Clinton, the ad says. He tells the truth. Although Tsongas is tapping into money from the Greek community, his funds are drying up. But he received a boost in Illinois this morning from the Chicago Tribune, which endorsed him as the candidate best suited to change the Democratic Party. While all three candidates have been trying to win the support of organized labor, union leaders are skeptical of both Tsongas and Clinton. Some are leaning toward Jerry Brown, who they say does not represent business as usual. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Chicago.
President Bush campaigned today in Michigan, promising to veto fuel efficiency regulations that could make cars more expensive. The rule he opposes would require new cars to be equipped with anti-pollution canisters designed to cut down gasoline fumes escaping into the air. The president also promised to veto legislation that would require automakers to raise their cars' average fuel mileage from 27.5 to 40 miles per gallon. The commander of the United Nations peacekeeping force in Yugoslavia, General Satish Nambiar, arrived in Sarajevo today. He voiced optimism that the 14,000 UN troops will be deployed as soon as possible. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Sarajevo.
General Nambiar arrived in Sarajevo after traveling to Belgrade and Zagreb, where he had talks with Serbian and Croatian officials, which he described as positive. The UN troops are to be deployed in Croatia, where a six-month ethnic war between Croatians and Serbs has claimed an estimated 6,000 lives. The general said he has sent out reconnaissance groups to the areas where the troops are to be deployed. But a spokesman for the UN forces said there are many details still to be worked out, including the precise limits of deployment and even where the troops will be housed. Nambiar said that the troops' primary aim will be to separate the warring sides, adding that police and civilian contingents will assist local administrations in restoring order and enforcing peace. This operation is one of the UN's biggest and marks the first of its kind in Europe, and there is widespread concern that it may prove one of the most challenging. This is Silvia Poggioli in Sarajevo.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 27 points to close at 3,235.9. This is NPR. The Senate has rejected a plan that would pay for a middle-class tax cut by freezing spending rather than increasing taxes on the rich. The proposal came in the form of an amendment proposed by Wisconsin Republican Robert Casten. It would have frozen most domestic spending programs at current levels for 4 years. The amendment failed on a vote of 61 to 36 after opponents argued that it would violate current budget restrictions. President Bush has vowed to veto any Senate measure that contains a tax increase. 1 million elderly Americans live in residential group homes. A congressional study released today documents an alarming pattern of drug abuse in those homes. NPR's Patricia Naymond reports.
Congressional investigators say that 85% of the boarding home residents were taking at least two different kinds of tranquilizers every day, and most staff were unfamiliar with the side effects of these commonly prescribed drugs. There are about 68,000 residential homes across the country. They provide meals and personal care, but not the medical care provided by skilled nursing facilities. Congressional officials said today that because these boarding homes are being used more and more for frail elderly people, they should be subject to the same regulation as nursing homes, which now prohibit the use of tranquilizers unless there is medical need. Bills now in Congress would do just that, but even if passed, it still could be a couple of years before they take effect. I'm Patricia Naymond reporting.
Caterpillar and the United Auto Workers have agreed to resume talks aimed at ending a 19-week strike, but they still haven't been able to agree on a date. Almost 11,000 of Caterpillar's 16,000 UAW workers are on strike. The union wants a new contract patterned on one that's already been negotiated with Caterpillar's heavy equipment competitor, John Deere & Company. The two sides haven't met since February 19th. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lanford Wilson, is one of the playwrights who created the off-off-Broadway scene in the 60s. His work was so popular, it ended up on Broadway. John Malkovich starred in the Broadway production of Wilson's Burn This. Wilson won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1980 play, Tally's Folly, one in a series of plays about the Tally family of Lebanon, Missouri, Wilson's hometown. Critic Clive Barnes described the Tally family as having become part of the legend of American theater. Wilson's other plays include Bomb in Gilead and Hotel Baltimore, which set a performance record for off-Broadway theater and became the basis for a TV series of the same name. Wilson is still a member of the Circle Repertory Theater, which he co-founded in 1969. His new play, Redwood Curtain, is about a 17-year-old Amerasian girl who goes in search of her father. She knows he's a Vietnam veteran and suspects that he's one of the homeless vets living in the Redwood Forest of Northern California. Wilson intends to take the play to Broadway. It opened earlier this week in Philadelphia. I spoke with him a few hours before curtain time. We started by talking about how he became a playwright. Wilson told me he was living in Chicago when he discovered he could write plays.
I thought I was going to be a painter, and I was writing stories to sell to magazines in order to support my painting habit. And, of course, I didn't sell anything. And one day I thought of a story and said, oh, that's probably a play, and started writing it as a play and said, what do you know? I'm a playwright. It was as clear as day. So there's only place, there was no theater activity in Chicago at the time at all. And it didn't occur to me to make theater activity in Chicago. A playwright lived in New York, so I had to come to New York.
So you got to New York and...
I hadn't written a play yet. I'd written maybe two little plays, but I was a playwright anyway.
So where did you go to find your connections?
I was very lucky. I've just been very lucky all along. I met someone on the street. They said, what do you do? And I said, I'm a playwright. And they said, oh, do you know the Cafe Chino? Never heard of it. All I've heard of is Broadway, of course. I went down to the Cafe Chino, which was had just started the year before doing one-act plays, and introduced myself to Joe Chino, who ran the place. And he said, what sign are you? And I said, Aries. And he said, oh, God, those wild Aries. Why don't you write a play for us? And I did. And then I had a play about every 3 months there, a one-act play for about 4 years.
This is like a small coffee house.
Seat 25, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a small coffee house. And they did a play at 9 and 11. They did a one-act play.
So I guess this is a good, safe, non-threatening way to get started.
Exactly. It was an internship or an apprenticeship. No one working there knew that, but that's exactly what it was. What better situation than to have a place that will do your play the day you finish it? You start rehearsal the next day if you want to, and you can see it immediately with an audience and see what worked and what didn't, and then write another play.
Now, I know that Joe Chino, who ran the place, killed himself in, I think, 67.
67, right.
And what I read was that he stabbed himself to death 100 times.
About that, probably. He was a crazy Italian. And he was incredibly depressed for over a week. And he put wild opera music on the speakers, stereo in the place, and stabbed himself with a butcher knife. Actually, he was living. He didn't die right then. He was living, and at the hospital, they said they thought he was going to recover. There wasn't brain damage, and he was beginning to recover, and his heart couldn't take the strain, and he had a heart attack and died. He never regained consciousness, but would have.
Was that the most wildly... flamboyantly self-destructive act you'd ever heard of from someone who you knew?
Yes, it was profoundly depressing. I'd never thought about suicide before that. It had never entered my life. It had never entered my vocabulary, and from that day, it's been a constant presence. It's like your father had killed himself. It's supposed to be a constant presence with the son. It's been a constant presence since then. And it had never crossed my mind before. Just because we were all so close to him, he was also one of the happiest people I'd ever met, or one of the most joyous persons I'd ever met. And it was just a profound shock. No one could believe it. We all stood around for days outside the place and sat around inside the place, not really knowing what to do with ourselves.
What effect did it have on you as a writer to see...
Well,
see this happen to somebody who you knew.
The possibility is there in all the characters now. I mean, it's there because it's there in everyone. It's there now in every character you write.
In the late 1960s, you co-founded Circle Repertory Theater in New York. What was the philosophy of the group?
Frankly, we wanted to become the Great American Theater, the Great American Theater Company, but we had done a number of plays. The group, even before we were founded, Marshall and I and Rob Thorkiel and Tanya, we'd done a number of plays that had large casts and ensemble acting that just took forever to rehearse and forever to get right. And in order to create an ensemble, you have to totally trust everyone else on stage with you. Because otherwise you're going to make a very large choice, and the actor is going to leave you hanging out there. I've seen actors on stage actually look at the audience like, "What in the hell was that all about?" When someone makes this huge, enormous choice. Well, so the actor, you have to trust that person to be there for you, and if that person is there for you, you can make deeper choices, and that person can make deeper choices, and it just you can just create a much fuller, farther out, more profound experience, and that can only happen in ensemble, or if you happen to know the actor very well, or if you happen to be directed right. And so we wanted to create an ensemble, that kind of an ensemble that would take chances, and would not leave the other person hanging out there. Also, the idea was to do a combination. We're not doing classics now, but for years we did. We'd do two classics and three original plays each year because we wanted to train the actors to do classics and then have that instrument, that classical instrument, available to contemporary writers. In other words, the best actors we could get. And the contemporary writers would teach the actors how to act, and the classics which would elevate them, and it was to be hoped that that the writers would also be stimulated by the classics.
Was it your ambition to get to Broadway, or had you given up on Broadway?
Given up on it completely. We really had no interest in Broadway at all. I think maybe distantly in our mind, there was probably a 399 seat house somewhere in the village where we would end up as our permanent home, but not a Broadway house, because we wanted to do a number of plays a year instead of running something for a commercial run. Nothing had transferred then. Nothing had, when we formed the theater, there wasn't the movement that there is now of plays from regional theaters to Broadway and from off-Broadway to off-Broadway and off-Broadway to Broadway. Things weren't doing that. So it never crossed our mind that that if we had something that was a commercial hit, that we could move it to Broadway.
If you're just joining us, my guest is playwright Lanford Wilson, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Lanford Wilson, and his plays include Hotel Baltimore, Tally's Folly, The 5th of July. His new play, The Redwood Curtain, has just opened in Philadelphia. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. I guess it's playwright Lanford Wilson. One of your early successes was Hotel Baltimore. And This was about people in a hotel that's condemned.
Yes.
And in your early days in New York, you lived in welfare hotels, right?
Right. I lived at the. I first lived at a place that I never did learn the name of it. I think the hotel did not have a name.
Was it called Hotel?
it should have been. It was right across the street from Manhattan Hotel, and they answered the phone with something incomprehensible. I never did hear what it was. It sounded sort of like Hevro, and so we called it the Hevro Hilton. But it was definitely a welfare hotel. And then I moved from there down to the down to Broadway Central, and the week I moved out of the Broadway Central, the hotel collapsed.
Wow!
It fell completely into the ground. Fortunately, it did it slowly. It did it over a period of about a day and a half, so everyone got out. But I had a lot of experience with that kind of hotel.
Did you lay awake often at night overhearing fights that were happening in the halls or in other rooms?
Like that scene in the movie Big. I just saw the movie Big on television last night. Let's see. When I slept was the hours that I didn't go to sleep until about 8 in the morning back then. And so I had a nice quiet sleep. I was part of the people that was making the noise so other people couldn't sleep, probably.
What were you doing all night?
Well, I was writing, and the whole neighborhood was such a... it was the middle of Needle Park. It was such an enormous shock to me and so thrilling because the neighborhood was filled with hustlers and pimps and prostitutes and drag queens. I'd never seen anything like it in my life.
Not everybody would find that thrilling.
Well, it was thrilling to me. I thought it was the most colorful place I'd ever seen in my life. Also, there were a bunch of guys from Columbia, so I was learning Spanish, which I...
Not Columbia University.
Didn't learn. Not from Columbia University. From Columbia and Costa Rica. And Costa Rica University. So I just found it thrilling. I would walk right up to a pusher and say, how exactly does a drug transition work? And where do you get the dope from? And they'd say, get out of here, kid. Because I just wanted to know how everything worked. I thought it was really exciting. So I was usually downstairs in, this is all Baum and Gilead. I was usually downstairs with the Baum and Gilead crowd in that coffee shop.
Yeah, let me explain that Baum and Gilead is a play that takes place in an all-night diner.
An all-night diner,
it's a diner that's frequented mostly by drug dealers and pimps and prostitutes and other small-time criminals.
Yeah.
So what attracted you to people like that? You were from the Midwest?
Yeah, from a very proper upbringing in the Midwest. Grew up on a farm. And what did attract me to it? I just think it was... it was raw enterprise that attracted me. Everyone was out to make a buck, which is true of everyone everywhere, but it was just so raw and bold and obvious there that when I was writing Baum and Gilead, I always said I could really be writing about Wall Street. It would be exactly the same. And that's what I was trying. I was looking at the economics of it. Also, they had such a great sense of humor about themselves. There were at least five. There was a drag queen and a drug dealer and a fantastic prostitute who just would sit around dishing the dirt, and it was the funniest dialogue I'd ever heard in my life. I didn't ever get the prostitute into a play until I wrote Hotel Baltimore, and then finally the part that Conchita Farrell played, April Green. Finally, I got that prostitute into it. You couldn't say a word to that woman without a comeback.
So what did all the hustlers and con men and drug dealers bring out in you? What surfaced in you?
Oh, I was their pet. I mean, they knew I was writing down every word they said because I would walk up and say, would you repeat that, please? And they thought I was the cutest thing they'd ever seen. You know, they thought I was really very silly. You know, they kind of protected me. I think they felt very protective. I when I finished the play, Baum and Gilead, I gave it to a couple of people I'd written about, like an idiot, to read and check for errors. And they read it and said, well, that's more or less what it's like, you know.
Do you think if you weren't so naive, it wouldn't have been that easy?
Oh, I'm sure. If I hadn't been that naive, I would have probably been horrified. But and now I'm a little bit shocked at the society that I moved in back then. I can't quite believe that I was in the place when someone was murdered there. That was really horrifying enough. Someone walked in with a knife and stabbed someone and turned around and walked out. We didn't know the person who was stabbed at all. They were from another neighborhood, and we didn't know the people who stabbed him. It was just very alarming, but it was the sort of thing that could easily have happened there at any time. It just hadn't.
Well, after plays like Baum and Gilead and Hot Old Baltimore, you eventually turned to completely different subject matter, which was a family from the Midwest, the Tally series of
plays. The Tally
plays.
Series, right.
It was a family from the Midwest, from Lebanon, Missouri, which I think is where you're originally from.
Yeah, I was born in Lebanon.
Yeah, so this is a family that's not your family, but not probably
not,
unlike...
Not at all my family.
Okay, yeah, but your family must have some connection to them. So how did you turn from this family that was very exotic, very not like you at all, you know, the Baum and Gilead crew,
right.
Turn from that to a Midwestern family who absorbed you for five plays?
Yeah, I think they were kind of exotic to me. My connection with that family is my mother cleaned for them.
Oh.
So they were sort of, these were the rich people that lived up on the hill, and they were exotic to me. I had always wanted to write about them. I had spent hours talking to various members of this family and other people like that. So the whole class, I'd go with my mother and she would clean the house, and I would talk to the cook and the lady of the house and the kids that live there. So I always was very strongly attracted to all of those rich kids because we were very poor, and examined them. I mean, you know, I would, on the rare times when I went to their houses, you know, I would ask the mother to take me through the house so I could see the way they lived. It was fascinating to me.
Explain what it was about the Tally family that you created, the family that was originally loosely based on the family that your mother cleaned for. I mean, what absorbed you in that family enough to bring you back about five different times?
I think they were America for me. I think they were changing so much. The war had a very profound effect on them. The country was changing, and they were changing, and were not coping particularly well with the change. And that, I think, was the first thing that drew me to them. The whole idea of family is very interesting to me because it's not at all the way the politicians talk about. We have to create a strong family unit, and everything is for the family. Well, bull hockey. I mean, families are about the most destructive things that's ever been invented. They're horrible. And there are so few families that work. Half the families and half the people in the country don't have two parents. You could name on one hand anyone in a class of, say, 60 that has one meal with the entire family sitting down together. That doesn't happen anymore. I wonder if it ever did. And also the meals that we had at home were the most horrible experiences of my life.
What kind of food?
Well,
it wasn't the food so much as the company, as
my stepfather telling us all how to eat, and you know, and it was his only chance to torture the family altogether, and so he made the most of it.
Do you have a group of people you think of as being your family, even though it's not a nuclear family?
Yes. The Circle Rep is my family, yeah. Either Circle Rep or there's another small little adjunct to that. I live in Sag Harbor, and there are few neighbors there that are also, I also feel of as very, very important to me.
So did you grow up thinking I don't want a family. I don't need a family. I'm going to go my own way.
No, I grew up thinking I'm going to have a family. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to raise it right. It's all, you know, everyone's going to love everyone. And that all just frittered away into nothing eventually.
Why? You gave up on
it? I was completely uninterested in it after a while. Also, I discovered as I grew up that I didn't really like children, which was a real disappointment to me. But they're loud and noisy little monsters that annoy me and get on my nerves. And I really hate that about myself, but there's no point in denying it. I just can't bear them. Also, they keep the most destructive hours.
This is coming from the guy who stays up all night writing, right?
Don't do that anymore.
Yeah. I'm sure everybody would tell you that if it were your children, you'd feel differently.
I'm sure. Right. I'm sure I would.
Do you ever worry about off-Broadway dying, in part because of cable and television?
No, not because of television. I worry about it dying because I don't really, because I think there's always new blood coming into mm-hmm. it. But there's always new people coming to town that want to put on a show, or they want the experience, and they're going to find an off-Broadway somewhere to do that. And if they don't do it in New York, they'll do it in Chicago. Well, they're doing it in Chicago. They'll do it in Seattle, and they're doing it in Seattle. They'll do it in San Francisco, and they're doing it there in L.A. And probably Atlanta as well, and a number of other places. It's happening all across the country. They're now off-Broadway, and off-Broadway is in Seattle and San Francisco. So really, when you're asking, do you worry about off-Broadway dying, it's do you worry about new plays coming up and that energy dying? And I don't, because I think it's going to be happening somewhere, because there's always going to be people who need to write plays. It's just a completely different experience from going to a movie or from writing for the movies. There's always going to be people who are interested in the literature of the theater.
So what are you going to wear to the opening tonight?
I have to find a shirt. I've got a really nice sport coat, a pair of gray pants that don't quite match. I've got my hard shoes in town. I'm going to wear my hard shoes and a pair of clean socks, got a clean pair of shorts, new T-shirt, and I have to find a shirt. Either that or I have to iron a shirt. I did all of my laundry, and so all of my shirts are very clean, but they're really kind of rumpled. So I have to go out and find a shirt or a sweater or something to wear with that jacket.
Well, I'll let you get to it.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
It's been fun.
My interview with Lanford Wilson was recorded on Wednesday, just before the opening of his new play, Redwood Curtain, at the Zillerbach Theater in Philadelphia. A short postscript, the New York Times reports today that talk of resignations abound at the Circle Repertory Theater after the postponement of the Broadway production of Redwood Curtain. Circle Rep's board has refused to provide the necessary financial support to bring the play to Broadway. Other options are being explored. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, back to the roots of rock and roll with Dave Alvin. In the first half of the 80s, he and his brother Phil led the roots rock band The Blasters. Dave wrote the songs and played lead guitar. Then Dave was the guitarist for X. Now he's writing songs for himself. We'll talk with Alvin and hear some of his latest solo album. In 1952, Orson Welles' Othello won the grand prize at the Cannes Film Festival. But soon after, the film vanished from sight. Now a new restoration of Othello has given the film a second life. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Presidential candidates are focusing their efforts in the Midwest, seen next week of two state primaries, Illinois and Michigan. President Bush campaigned today in Michigan, where he promised to propose relief for U.S. automakers of some federal regulations. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
At the Economic Club of Detroit, the president promised to veto any legislation which would force automakers to increase fuel efficiency standards. He said the so-called CAFE requirements have cost U.S. jobs and resulted in smaller, less safe cars. Voters in Michigan are worried about the economy and are upset over General Motors plant closings. President Bush responded to a charge by a Michigan senator that the president played a role in a GM decision to close a Michigan plant instead of one in his home state of Texas.
And I'm standing here to tell you, with everything I can muster, that I made no such intervention, and I take it as a direct attack on my character to have a United States senator say that. It is a bald-faced lie.
Elsewhere in Detroit today, GOP challenger Pat Buchanan campaigned, criticizing the president's trade policy and promising to force the Japanese to accept American cars for every car they sell here. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Tonight, Democratic presidential contenders Bill Clinton, Paul Tsongas, and Jerry Brown take part in a three-man debate in Chicago to be broadcast in both primary states. A strong earthquake has hit northeastern Turkey, one that U.S. officials say measured 6.8 on the Richter scale. Mike Theodoulou in Cyprus has been monitoring Turkish news reports and reports local officials believe there may be heavy casualties with at least 300 people killed.
The acting provincial governor of Erzincan province, the worst hit area, says the 30-second quake destroyed two hotels, eight office buildings, the city hospital, and workers' apartment blocks. He fears a high casualty count. The quake hit shortly after nightfall and was felt in at least 13 other provinces. Details are coming in slowly because phone links were cut. Police have made distress calls for help. They ask for earth-moving equipment and doctors. How many casualties there are will depend very much on the type of dwellings the people have in the rural areas of the rugged mountainous region and on the rock and soil formations. The quake was certainly less powerful than the one that hit northern Iran 2 years ago, killing 40,000 people. That measured 7.7 on the Richter scale. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
Wholesale prices moved up a bit last month, rising 0.2%. The government says the increase came from a jump in food prices led by a surge in the price of vegetables. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 27 points to close at 3,235.91 in active trading. This is NPR News. Yugoslavia, three policemen were shot to death a short time before the arrival of the commander of UN peacekeeping forces in the region. The European community has given diplomatic recognition to Croatian Slovenia, but is awaiting a referendum in Bosnia on independence. In the worst week of violence since a UN-sponsored truce was agreed upon in January, at least 20 people have been killed and more than 30 others wounded. New York City, UN Secretary General Boutros-Boutros-Ghali says that he will send U.S. diplomat Cyrus Vance to Azerbaijan and Armenia next week. The two former Soviet republics are locked in continued fighting over Nagorno-Karabakh. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Vance, who served as U.S. Secretary of State under President Carter, may leave for the former republics Monday night. He will also visit the disputed Armenian enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh inside Azerbaijan. An estimated 1,500 people have died in the fighting between the two former republics over the past 4 years. The leaders of both states have asked for the U.N. to intervene, and Azeri leaders have even spoken of having U.N. peacekeeping troops stationed on the borders between the two states. Vance is being sent to the area on a fact-finding mission. The 75-year-old official recently played a key role in negotiating a ceasefire between the warring republics of Yugoslavia. The ceasefire has held since early January, and UN officials are now making plans to send peacekeeping troops there. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Police in Hong Kong have been placed in the highest alert because of a crime wave blamed on criminals from mainland China. Yesterday, more than $1 million in gold and diamonds was stolen in one robbery, and nearly $90,000 was taken in another. Earlier this week, more than $1 million was lost in a holdup. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As rock music has gotten more technically and electronically advanced, and in some cases more pretentious as well, there's been a wave of bands going back to the roots of the music, back to blues, R&B, and rockabilly. One of the American bands at the forefront of that movement in the early 80s was the Blasters. The group was led by Phil and Dave Alvin, two brothers from a working-class neighborhood in L.A. Phil was the lead singer, younger brother Dave wrote the songs and played lead guitar. After several albums, Dave left the band in 86. He played guitar with X for a while, then went solo. Dave Alvin has just released his second solo album called Blue Boulevard. Before we meet him, let's hear the title track.
This empty road in this lonely town, no one's up when the sun goes down. Turn around and cruise once more by the old parking pass abandoned stores. Oh, baby, it drives me crazy, 'cause every day I work the same old job, waiting for the night to fall. Then I'm on the street that once was ours, a street light shining down just like stars. Oh, baby, you drove me crazy, 'cause I hung your picture on my rearview mirror, but when I look back, you're not there. And every night I remember, we took a ride in my car. I aimed straight for heaven, but I ended up on Blue Boulevard.
Dave Alvin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
You, for years, wrote songs for other people. In the Blasters, you wrote songs that your brother Phil would sing.
Yeah.
How is it different writing for you?
With my brother, for example, he was probably the pickiest person as far as what words. He would sit down with me, and we'd go word by word through a song, and he'd go, "No, I don't like that. Get that out of there. Use was," or, you know. And I'd have to write things that he and I had shared, you know, experiences or environmental things. Like, I had one song that I wrote called "The Border Radio," and he and I grew up listening to border radio stations. So it's like, okay, he can relate to this, I can relate to this. And then towards the end of the Blasters, I just kind of ran out of things that we had shared. You know, I couldn't write real personal songs because I'd gone through things that he hadn't gone through, and vice versa. And so I think probably the major difference is I don't have a censor. You know, I think every writer, you know, has a censor inside of them saying, this stinks, you know. And by not having to worry about what someone else would sing, got rid of a sort of a needless censor and just left me with my own personal censor, which also says, this stinks, you know.
Okay, and in talking about writing personal songs that you couldn't write for somebody else, I want to play a song called Andersonville. I don't know if this comes under that category or not. It's really not about you. It's about a soldier during the Civil War who fights on the Union side and ends up in a Confederate prison.
Yeah, but it's about my great-great uncle or great-great granduncle, a guy named Asa Powell, who died in Andersonville, and we were, I guess I was about 8 years old, 7 years old, and I got this box, a little tiny box from my Aunt Margaret, who's sort of the historian of the family. And inside the box were two photographs of him, one on tin, which was a photograph of him when he enlisted, and he was, you know, like 17, 18 years old, and had this big bright face, and he's in his uniform, and he's all happy. And then there's a photograph from about 3 or 4 years later from Andersonville on glass, just this very, very cheap, very, you know, almost, you can barely see it now. It was so, you know, sort of cheaply done. And he is, you know, like I said, 3 years older, and he looks 70. So that's always been like, you know, I guess my connection with some kind of past. We were not a real, family that went in for the genealogy stuff, but that was like this living thing. And anyway, when I decided to start writing songs again and make a record, that was actually the song that did it. I was looking through that stuff one day, this was about a year and a half ago, and all of a sudden a little bell went off in my head, said, this would be a great song, you know?
Well,
and,
this, yeah.
And then I thought, just let me prattle on for a while. and then I thought, Dave, there's a reason why you're not top of the pops, you know? No one writes Civil War songs anymore, especially where people die, you know? And so I wrote the song and played it for a couple people. And the first person I played it for, his reaction was, oh, thanks, Dave. Can I commit suicide now? and I really thought I was a jerk. And then about 2 months later, the Ken Burns thing, the PBS Civil War show came on. And I went, instantly I went from being a jerk to being a cliche. You know, it's like, oh, man, I can't put this out. This is now, boy, and everybody's going to say he's trying to get on PBS or something. And I actually wasn't going to put the song on the record, but the producers talked me into it. It's a personal song in the sense that it's probably, for me, in a weird way, the funnest song to sing, because I can get out a lot of frustrations it does tie into my personal life, and I can't go into it because I'd probably be sued or something, but it's a very, I'm going to mispronounce this word, but it's a very cathartic thing to sing, if that makes any sense.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a song about death and depression and isolation, and so who couldn't relate to some of that? Well, let's. That sounded pretty grim, didn't it? getting into a mood here.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear Andersonville, and this is from Dave Alvin's new album, Blue Boulevard.
In the spring of 61. I kissed my mother goodbye. I put on a blue uniform and I fought for Lincoln's side. Until I got caught by Johnny Reb in the woods near Chapel Hill. And I wish to God he'd have killed me then, but he sent me to Andersonville. My uniform has faded, and there's no boots upon my feet. And I'm pulling worms out of the mud, 'cause there's nothing else to eat. And the Reds can't even feed their own, so there's no way they can fill the bellies of the Yankees starving in Andersonville.
That's some of Andersonville from Dave Alvin's new album, Blue Boulevard. Just to make matters perhaps a little bit more depressing, I think you were actually kind of ill when you were writing the song. I know you had meningitis for a while, and
yeah.
It seems like you probably wrote this during that period.
Wrote it right after, and yeah, I guess maybe a stay in the hospital would definitely make you think you're in a prison camp. I don't know. I'm not good with confined spaces.
Singer, songwriter, and guitarist Dave Alvin is my guest. He has a new album called Blue Boulevard. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Blue Boulevard.
My guest is Dave Alvin. Let's hear something from his days with the Blasters. This is Marie Marie. Dave wrote it and is featured on lead guitar. Brother Phil does the vocals.
Marie Marie, playing guitar on the back porch. I sit in my car. Why she sings so sad, Marie Marie. Marie Marie, it's so lonely in these farmlands. Please come with me to the bright lights downtown, Marie Marie.
What did the early Blasters sound like? Before you started recording?
Before we started recording, we sounded like, we sounded more like the Ramones. because that's really what got us back into music was
punk?
Yeah, was the Ramones and the Clash and stuff like that.
Did you ever, with the Blasters or with X, play in any of the punk clubs in Los Angeles or anywhere else?
No, we never did anything. What do you talk? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, what do you want to know?
Well, I you know, you really liked the music and played the music, but how did you relate to the audience?
Well, in the early days, I felt like in the early days, before even we got the Blasters together, I mean, I was going to punk shows, so I felt like I was the audience, you know, I was part of the audience. And in the early days of the Blasters, we would go, you know, we would, our itineraries were hilarious in a way, something that could never happen today. We would play like a Tuesday night at a country bar, Wednesday night at a biker bar. Thursday night, we'd open for a new wave band, not punk, but we'd open for a new wave band. And then on Friday night, we'd open for a Black Flag, you know? And it was pretty incredible, you know? And you know, I mean, I have two of my favorite periods of my life are hanging out with, you know, being a little kid with Big Joe Turner and living a couple years during that L.A. rock scene. That was pretty good.
How did you get to hang out with Big Joe Turner?
We just followed him. I mean, there's a long story. I mean, we literally followed him until they took notice. They couldn't help, you know. And my brother would go up. My brother, already at the age of, like, whatever, 14, could sing exactly like Big Joe Turner. And Big Joe just loved that, you know. Or we'd already been collecting 78s. So when we'd go see Lowell Fulsom or T-Bone Walker, we could say, you know, oh, well, we got your record, you know, from 1941 or 42. And they would be floored.
In addition to writing lyrics, you write poems.
Yeah.
And that's sometimes something that really frightens me. because sometimes the poems aren't nearly as good as the lyrics. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot of people who write kind of bad poetry and try to not get into it. but I really like your poems, and I'd ask you to read one, and I thought I'd ask you to read one that seemed very unlike the kind of subject you'd write a song about. And the poem is called My Mother Fell.
Okay.
You're welcome to introduce it if you'd like.
Yeah, usually my mother was dying, and that's really, I guess that says it all, I guess. My mother fell this afternoon. My mother fell and hit her head on grandmother's jagged wooden table. Strips of her flaky skin clung to the table's sharp edge. I let go of her. I let go of her because she said she was cold. I left her standing alone in her walker as I went for her sweater. But the drugs or the chemotherapy had taken away her coordination, and she lost her balance in her walker, and she fell. I let go of her. My mother fell this afternoon like she was a baby, taking her first steps. The pink skin of her forehead quickly turned purple. A small slash of blood dripped into her half-closed eyes. My mother fell this afternoon, and my tears fell into her eyes as I tried to lift her back up. My mother fell this afternoon, my tears with her blood. My mother fell this afternoon. My mother fell.
I think it's a wonderful poem.
Oh, thanks.
Could you ever do a song like that?
I don't know. Maybe these days, yeah. You know, maybe these days I'm probably, I mean, if I can write something like Andersonville or something, I could probably do that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Dave Alvin's latest record is called Blue Boulevard. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, are you following the presidential candidates preparing for next Tuesday's primaries?
We are, Terry. We'll be hearing about also about anti-incumbent sentiment in Illinois from Cheryl Duvall and what farmers in Illinois think about the primaries from Linda Wertheimer. Also today, we'll tell you how many blueberries you're really likely to find in a blueberry bagel. What is new in Albania? Tom Gjelten is there as they're preparing for elections and the country is descending into chaos. And we'll also be hearing what's new with the famed British heavy metal group, Spinal Tap. I'll be talking with two of them today about their new album, Break Like the Wind.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The late director Orson Welles struggled for 4 years to make his film of Shakespeare's Othello, but shortly after it won the grand prize at the 1952 Cannes Film Festival, the movie flopped, and then, even worse, virtually disappeared. Over 3 decades later, an original negative was found in a New Jersey warehouse, and now Welles' Othello has been lovingly restored. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to see how it's held up.
Everyone knows the myth of Orson Welles. How he emerged from his success in radio to direct his first film at the age of 25, and how that film, Citizen Kane, the most amazing debut in movie history, was also the masterpiece that more or less ruined him. From then on, the story goes, his was a sorry tale of decline, until he wound up fat and unloved selling No Wine Before Its Time on TV. Well, that myth is exactly that, a myth. Citizen Kane is a stupendous film, but if you subtracted it from the Welles canon, you'd still have a body of work that places him among the greatest movie directors who ever lived. I'm talking about the man who made The Magnificent Ambersons, Touch of Evil, The Lady from Shanghai, Chimes at Midnight, and The Immortal Story, all splendid films. And add to that list Othello, too, a triumph of mood and tone, and above all, of ingenuity. Welles made Othello under such crazy conditions, in so many different locations, with so many different actors, that, as he once put it, there are scenes in which Iago changed continents in the middle of a phrase. The movie's full of shadowy, hooded figures, and sometimes the reasons are purely practical. Since the actor who began the scene 1 year may have been miles away when Welles finally raised the money to finish it, a lot of the people whose faces you can't quite make out are stand-ins, and all the movie's dialogue is dubbed. Welles's Othello is severely condensed from the original Shakespeare, and purists won't like some of the changes and rearrangements of dialogue. The villain Iago, for instance, has always been something of a mystery. He's General Othello's right-hand man, but he also plots Othello's downfall by making the Moor think his innocent wife Desdemona has been unfaithful. In the end, Othello becomes so distraught that he kills her. Shakespeare's attempts to explain Iago's motives have never been very clear, but in this Othello, the villain is more mysterious than ever. Iago says he hates the Moor, and that's about as much motivation as you get. Fortunately, the Irish actor Michael McLeanmore makes a superb Iago, wheedling and epicene and seething with nameless and solitary resentment. He's the perfect foil for Welles' own heroic but somewhat bland portrayal of the Moor himself. In this scene, Iago begins sowing the seeds of jealousy, hinting that Desdemona has been having an affair with the young lieutenant Cassio. In fact, Cassio had been a go-between when Othello was courting Desdemona. Anything wrong with that, asks Othello? Or is there something not quite on the level about Cassio?
Is he not honest?
Honest, my lord?
Honest, aye, honest.
My lord, for aught I know.
What dost thou think?
Think, my lord.
Think? Thou dost mean something. I heard thee say even now thou likes not that when Cassio left my wife. Thou dost love me. Show me thy thoughts.
My lord, you know I love you.
I think thou dost.
For Michael Cassio, I dare be sworn I think he's honest.
I think so too.
men should be what they seem.
Certain men should be what they seem.
Why, then, I think Cassio is an honest man.
Nay, yet there's more in this.
In that scene, you can hear the gist of Wells's interpretation. He's made an Othello that is almost exclusively about the way jealousy grows and consumes even the most noble mind. And the striking look of the movie serves his approach. Filming in Morocco and Italy among empty castles and cliffs, Wells has made a picture that's all air and sky and bright Mediterranean sunshine. And yet the way he uses arcades and towers and stone vaults makes the film feel ironically claustrophobic. He's showing how jealousy shrivels even the most spacious sensibility, how the demons in Othello's mind fragment his bright world and hem him in. The movie has the stark pictorial beauty of an Eisenstein film, and almost as many cuts. The editing itself is astonishingly complex, and it adds to a surrealism in the movie that may remind you of the paintings of De Chirico. In a way, the film is no more authentically Shakespearean than Verdi's opera Otello is, but who cares? This Othello is Orson Welles at very nearly his best, and it proves once again that no one was ever better.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, and Naomi Person, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Nate Zelnick. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Cherry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the culture of complaint. We talk with Time magazine art critic Robert Hughes, a man who loves art, but not the art world. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.